Good morning. I'm Mrs. Mswedi, Hilda by name, member of this committee. Morning. My name is Rebecca Makosha Motsito, member of this committee.
Thank you. Thank you, members. You can see the members are still a little bit drunk because they slept late yesterday. They were having a Valentine this evening. So that still doesn't. We've got other people from the center. Muyoka next to me and Zube, who's our center. So, Minister, we give over to you. Can you introduce and then go in a short term? Tell us about it.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. And Dr. Carol Marshall, who a member of the senior management department, she'll be the main presenter. She's actually the principal senior management member who's trying to hold right from the beginning up to the end. And she's going to be the main presenter. Of course, to her, as you know, they have a
sometimes you never know. You and Gwen and Johannes, we never know whether you belong to us or you belong to the other, to the opposition. But be that way, let's have the presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by apologizing because I'm double passed. I'm also the Chairperson of the Resource Mobilization Committee, which is a subcommittee of SANAC falling under the deputy president, and they are having a meeting now that involves civil society. I asked them that I'll join them a little bit later, with your indulgence, Chairperson, and I'll leave the deputy minister and Dr. Carol Marshall. Be that as it may, Chairperson, I believe all bills that go through this or that house are very, very important. But I want to say that as far as I'm concerned, this particular one might bring a revolution which everybody in South Africa has been dreaming about. As we proposed the national health insurance, which of course took you to the silence, which is a concept that is you're going to be hearing a lot about for the whole world, the concept of universal coverage in healthcare finance. You might not have picked it when you went to Thailand because you didn't attend the international conference at one point. A decision was taken that this issue, just like HIV and AIDS and non-communicable diseases, might find its way to the United Nations General Assembly. At least the movement on universal coverage is going to make sure of that. Now, I'm raising this because quite a number of critics of NHI points to the quality of health care as the only thing that we should concern ourselves about. They found the two issues mutually exclusive, when actually they belong to each other. The National Health Insurance will never be successful without the quality of health care in the public sector. In fact, on the day we held a press conference to announce the release of the Green Paper, I mentioned that there are two preconditions for national health insurance to survive in South Africa. The first precondition is that the quality of health care in the public hospital has to improve. We need a complete overhauling, a complete change of the manner in which public hospitals are conducted, as we know them today. I have said that is the first condition. The second precondition 10% of the population. That will still be so even under NHI. There is a misconception, and I'm sorry, Chairperson, for people maybe will get confused why I'm mixing this with NHI, because they are very much related. The issue of Office of Standard Compliance has been in the National Health Act since 2003, but the office was never established since that time, meaning it's 9 years now that this was in the Act, but it was never established. But according to, as far as we are concerned, as the Department of Health, the time has arrived that we need to establish that office, because it will make an HI very difficult without there being quality of health care. So we regard it as a revolutionary bill that will change the manner in which South Africans perceive public health care. I am missing them because there was a time when some people, even prominent people within this country, thought once national health insurance is running, you can abandon public health care system and run private health care. And there will be some institution called national health insurance that will be paying for that. So you don't have to use public health facilities. That will never be possible in any part of this planet. It has never happened. And I don't see it happening in 1,000 years. That's not what national health insurance is. So that's why public hospitals have to function. They have to work. They have to be quality. Now, there are many areas which can be called key performance areas in terms of quality, performance of quality. Dr. Marshall is going to be presenting those. There are many standards. But we have identified 6 core standards which are going to be at the center of this. There will be many, but there will be 6 core standards, which we chose because even members of the public can identify and understand them. The other standards will be complex, will be understood by people like yourself at a high level. But an ordinary member of the public might find it very tough even to interpret them and to know that such standards are there in their public health facilities. And the 6 core standards, which we think every member of the public will have to know about and check and say, yes, I went to this hospital, I found those standards that we're speaking about, and I actually experienced them. The issue of cleanliness of our healthcare facilities, the issue of safety and security of patients, the issue of the attitude of staff, the health personnel, to individual patients who are seeking help in those institutions, the issue of infection control inside the institution, the issue of drug stock out, which has been a song that many South Africans have been singing and complaining about for quite a long time. Sometimes people even believe in that the government is not buying drugs when they are actually there. But some managers in institutions just don't believe it's their duty that they must make sure that drugs are there in their institutions rather than stay in the warehouse, as they quite often do. They don't believe their responsibility. So this bill is going to put that responsibility in each and every manager to make sure that they don't. I've been to some hospitals where some of the CEOs have never even gone to the pharmacy. They don't know how it looks like. But they are able to report that, no, they are the office is independent, but that structure still reports to the minister. So the same thing with this inspector. The other was a confusion between the health, environmental health inspector, the people who were called in the past were the medical inspector. Yeah, you are calling them health officers, but in the past, health inspectors were just called health inspectors. Now they are called environmental care officers. Yes, because we learn new modern terms. The simplest one is health inspector. People confuse them. The inspectors I'm not talking about, they are not health inspectors. Health inspectors are people who are hired like any public servant, who will go out and say this place is dirty, that restaurant is selling food that is going to make people seem not compliant to standards of hygiene. Those are public servants hired. They'll continue to be there. The inspectors we're talking about here are specifically employed by the Office of Standard Compliance to inspect the standards that Dr. Marshall is going to tell you about. Not only these six I'm mentioning them, because they are of clear public interest. Even members of the public, as I'm saying, can identify with. There will be other big standards like management of finances in that particular hospital, the maintenance of infrastructure, and many other standards that are complicated are going to be in this office by this particular inspector who will be working under a CEO. The other unit of this office is going to be the Ombuds Center. This is going to be a very, very critical process in South Africa. Judging from the complaints from members of the public, I think in the beginning it's going to be the busiest office, if I'm not mistaken, in our public life. Because at the moment, patients complain to newspapers. They go to the media and complain, make noise. Switch on the radio, you hear a patient complaining bitterly about what they went through, and sometimes they believe there's no record. We have got no proof whether the patient is just angry or bitter, or whether what they are saying is true. In most cases, they might be true, but we don't know. So there must be a statutory office that will go to check what actually happened. This will also give public servants, it will force them to be accountable. At the moment, chairperson, including all of you here, the only person that is accountable is the minister. If anything happens in any hospital, very far from Pretoria or Cape Town, the minister is responsible. Public servants are never regarded as taking responsibility. Never. Including CEOs, many of them are not even known. And they enjoy it. Just to say, no, I know if this thing happens, they'll blame the government. And they do so. And South Africans have actually learned that. Now, part of this is to give individual responsibility. The Uber person will be able to see, did this person get a raw deal? Because the CEO of this hospital doesn't have capacity. Or because the individual nurse or doctor, health worker, has gone wrong. Or a policy of government is not serving the institution very well. Will be able to, the Ombuds person will be able to defend that, so that the minister will take responsibility for whatever went wrong, if it's in terms of policy. But the CEO will also take responsibility if it's in terms of poor management. But the individual health worker, if they are of the wrong grade or they choose that profession wrongly, they don't have empathy or passion for their work, it will be determined. That's going to be the importance of the Ombuds person. And the last office, of course, will be an office of certification. Because no entity, whether public or private, will go under NHI unless it has been certified. And entities, health entities, will be certified in terms of this act. In other words, to say, yes, this is an institution where citizens of this country can go and receive their health care and is certified as such because it meets particular standards and requirements. That's going to be the function of this chairperson. And that's why I'm saying, to me, this is a very big revolution. Of course, there will be things which, because when we establish this chairperson, in the United Kingdom. Even though we are South Africa, we can't take everything. We need help there, but it's mirrored clearly on what they've been doing, because they've done it over a number of years, and they've got experience. Even with them, there is trouble. You inspect, and you get to a fight one day. What do you do? This debate is in the arena, so I'm voicing it because we're going to be debating about it. In the UK, they actually, after inspecting, in writing a public report, they grade the hospital from grade A to F. So members of the public must know that the institution is of A grade, meaning everybody is pulling their socks, everybody is trying their best. But members of the public might also know that our hospital has been graded F. I'm just giving an example. Not the Taliban would use the same thing. I'm using a cold one. They have been there in the UK. Then it becomes a big problem, whereby we have to give management some chance to go and improve. They have to and say, look, you got grade F. In other words, it's a fail. Because this is what your institution looks like. And so management will be forced to sit down. The work has then come. The hospital. But if they don't, within that given time, what then, in terms of the act, in terms of the labor law of the country, in terms of administrative justice act, in terms of the constitution, because all those will come together about the fact that the labor law says this is what you must do, the constitution of the country says, you know, this is, of course, that is the supreme law, nobody can about it, but all these things will come into play, and members of this committee will be called upon to navigate through that. What powers does this act have over the labor law? If, for instance, in terms of the inspectors, they say, no, it's on our best. We don't think this hospital's management makes the grade of ever bringing these standards into fruition. Will that pronouncement by the committee be above the labor laws or any other right that a worker or an individual has got in the country? That's what some of the sensitive things the committee must go through. Another sensitive area will be the other statutory bodies that's already been input and complained. For instance, if in terms of the attitude of an individual staff member, that staff member is a doctor, he's registered in the Health Professions Council. The Health Professions Council also has got jurisdiction over that. The office, of course, is not going to be responsible to individuals, but to the institution. But what if they found that the attitude of a particular, the ombuds person found that the attitude of a particular staff member is not something that we accept from a public servant of the people? They might then have to go and report that person to the statutory body, the Tennessee Council, or the Health Professions Council, or the Pharmacy Council, or whatever council. And what if that council neglects their duty? Sometimes it happens. And the office picks it up that no, the reason that the attitude of this health worker is like this is because the statutory professional body they report is not doing their work. The nurse is like this because the nursing council has left her to be like this for 10 years without taking any action. Now, the question will be, what powers does this office have over that statutory body, which is also, by the way, independent? Because all these bodies are independent by themselves, you know. So we have to navigate through that in terms of what is the powers of the Office of Standard Compliance in terms of attitude of staff to patients and negligence vis-à-vis the statutory body that has already been laid. Some members of the public who are wise will even ask, why do you now come with these things? Because these bodies have been there. That workers report to these statutory bodies. What's their job? But you will be aware that this act goes beyond individuals. Statutory bodies are there for particular individuals. This now goes to the whole institution, including the individual inside it, whether that institution is serving the public very well. So it's going to be a very interesting but tricky act which will need all your wisdom in terms of legislative powers, legislative competencies, and skills. And you are going to obviously find a lot of interest groups among members of the public seen by the inputs already. Because, for instance, you'll be having, when it comes to and very poor doesn't know how to handle workers. It's not us. If you get a good manager, this issue will be clean. And you know, so there will be such, because you are dealing with human beings, and we are believing for the first time in the history of the country, we're having an act to guide us, not just common sense management, but an act of parliament where our joking little CEO, that actually it means 8 years is going to be illegal in South Africa. Because it's, yes, if cleanliness is passed by an act, it means that this institution is going against the law. It's an illegal practice to leave a hospital dirty. And at any rate, I am happy as a minister, because a hospital is supposed to be the cleanest public space anywhere in the world. If you want the cleanest space anywhere in the life of human beings, that will have to be a hospital. I can't imagine any other area that demands cleanliness. And in South Africa, we find institutions like Parliament where the laws are made. And I'm not saying it's wrong. Much cleaner than hospitals. I would have been happy if it was the other way around. If Parliament is dirty, it will just be an embarrassment to us. But if a hospital is dirty, it might be dangerous and life-threatening, not just an embarrassment. But now we have allowed a situation in our country where sometimes it becomes a norm to allow a public hospital just to be dirty and nobody can see anything wrong. But for the first time, there will be an act that says, no, you can't do this. Otherwise, you'll be charged because you are going against the law of the country. So that basically the Office of Standard Compliance Chairperson, and maybe let me then give over to Dr. Marshall to navigate into the act. Thank you.
Maybe before Dr. Marshall says, no, we accept your apology, Minister. So as soon as you think you are ready to leave, you could just indicate that you are leaving and plan to leave. There are some other members who have just come. I just have to make this comment, Minister, that you know one thing that is really good about future, that future is really different. It depends on the past. It's a function of the past. So we definitely have to be positive about this. And if we're positive, it is going to shape us culturally. And all we know is that what we've been doing has not given us good fruit. So whether it comes out with good fruit or bad fruit, we don't know. But we're positive that it's going to give us. It gives us hope that the fact that we're trying to reform health services is going to be helping us. That it gives us a very big hope. The second big hope that you're getting is your passion. Your passion makes us feel that we will achieve what you want to achieve. But in this parliament, we assure you that we are going to make sure that this does not delay. We have to fast track it, because even ourselves, the oversight that we've done has shown us that things are not very good. So if we delay this thing, obviously, we are delaying the good things that our folks have been getting. So we promise you that we'll assist you in everything. The challenges that you are talking about, I don't think anybody prays not to have challenges, but our prayers are always going to say, we pray that when the challenges are there, we are able to manage them. And I'm sure we're going to be able to manage those challenges. We cannot, when we are in problems, you usually go to those who have done it and then show some something that proved to
that this amendment bill actually deals with, the amendment bill that is before us today, is really the terminology, because the previous Office of Standards Compliance was mentioned in Section 36. And the amendment is to alter the terminology to the Office of Health Standards Compliance, because the new body has the word health in it on the recommendation of Cabinet, who felt there were too many offices of standards compliance. So the amendment bill before the honourable members reflects the establishment of an Office of Health Standards Compliance. Section 47 in the original bill empowered the Director General to establish the Office of Standards Compliance within the Department of Health, but empowered the MECs of each province to establish an inspectorate, a provincial inspectorate of health establishments. And then Chapter 10, which was entitled Health Officers and Compliance Procedures, covered both the establishment of the inspectorate for health establishments by the MECs, the functions of the Office of Standards Compliance, which was to operate within the National Department of Health and was specified as including an ombudsperson, and then went through a fair amount of detail in terms of the functions, the inspections, the appointments, etc. And the bulk of the presentation today is actually about how we are proposing that Chapter 10 should be changed. So this is the current National Health Act. This process of reviewing how the Office of Standards Compliance should most usefully function if it is to achieve what the Minister outlined for us today started really with a decision in 2009 that placing an oversight body within the department which it is overseeing was not going to bring about the changes that were needed. There was therefore an early decision that an independent quality accreditation and management body should be established, and it was really from that decision that the subsequent work was done. As we all know, the issue of improving quality of care has been really pushed right up the agenda of priorities within the National Department of Health, as reflected in a number of the plans and policy position papers that you are all very familiar with. The national core standards, which you have in front of you and which we distributed today and which the Minister alluded to, were actually approved by the National Health Council in 2010 after extensive discussion, development, reworking, testing. So the documents that we distributed today are actually approved by the National Health Council as policy guidelines for the national health system. The National Health Council also took a number of key decisions which were fed into the amendment bill. Firstly, that this should be a national body, that it should be a national process, national standards, a national uniform process for inspections and certification. Secondly, that it was to cover health establishments in public and private sectors and at all levels of care. Thirdly, that it would through the Minister, advise on mandatory standards for compliance that would cover the key quality issues that the Minister alluded to, that it would issue certificates of compliance but not licenses to operate, that it would include an early warning system that would detect urgent problems, so it wouldn't wait for inspectors to arrive. It would include a system that would alert the office to when things are potentially going wrong in order to result in an urgent intervention. And lastly, that it would retain the complaints or ombuds function, which had been part of the original National Health Act. Based on this policy guidance and these policy decisions, the National Department of Health has been doing very, very extensive scoping or benchmarking exercises around the world, actually, but also in South Africa, with similar regulatory bodies and quality bodies around the functions that were proposed. And one of the first lessons that we picked up internationally is that it's absolutely essential that you know what you're trying to achieve, because there can be many objectives for a body like this. So the first lesson was that the choices you make must be based on why you're doing it. So what problems are you trying to solve? And written on the left-hand side was a synthesis of what led us to, what led the National Department of Health and the minister to decide that this was imperative. I think that that has been outlined already, but just to restate it, that the quality of care, in particularly in the public sector, but not only in the public sector, is unacceptable. It does not meet reasonable public expectations. That although the resources may not be absolutely sufficient, but certainly we could be achieving a lot more with the resources that we invest, and a lot of the problem is pinned on a lack of compliance. People simply don't follow the rules. They don't do what they're supposed to do. Thirdly, that if people don't do what they're supposed to do, the accountability systems are weak, and there are very few consequences if your hospital is dirty. And lastly, that the ethics and professionalism that should pervade in any health system are being eroded. With that as our diagnostic, as it were, the purpose of this new body was therefore, the choices were therefore made that it would focus on public accountability through a credible institution. Secondly, that it would ensure mandatory compliance. Thirdly, that in the long term it would become a prerequisite for funding through the NHI or universal coverage mechanism. What was therefore clear is that this body is not following the voluntary peer review and improvement model. That is not to say that that is not important, but it's complementary to what is effectively an inspectorate or a regulator. So that synthesizing our experience around the fact that you need to be clear what problem you're trying to address and therefore what are the tools to address it. We did, in the scoping work, we did review a number of different areas. We looked at how one assesses quality objectively, and I think the Minister has already alluded to some of that. We also looked at regulators. What were the regulators in general, not just in the health field, what were some of the critical aspects that regulators needed to take into account? The first one is the degree to which they are operationally independent, i.e. they can give a credible and objective view. The second is how do they enforce compliance? What are the different mechanisms to enforce compliance? And lastly, how do they prioritize? How do they make sure that they are addressing situations of the highest risk? And the last area that we looked at was the ombuds function of investigating complaints and recommending redress. These areas we covered specifically, and the information on these international and national scoping studies is available, but obviously I'm not going to be able to go into the depth of it today. I will, however, as we go through the bill, illustrate how some of these critical international lessons, we hope all of them, were incorporated in the proposal that it is contained in the bill. So you can see there the list of things that we actually looked at in this scoping study. The next section I'm going to go on to is the legislative process that was followed. That was really the policy process that was followed. So the next section will deal with how this was dealt with in the legislative process. So the draft amendment bill was approved by Cabinet in November 2010 and was gazetted for public comment between January and April last year. We received, and I'll go through in summary the comments that we received. The comments were received and incorporated into a revised bill that was approved by Cabinet in July 2011. And this then went to the state law advisors who certified it in November. So that is where we are now. This is a summary of the comments that were received. 28 organizations altogether, or individuals, commented on the bill. There were four private hospital groups. There were four professional associations or professional linked bodies. We received a lot of comments around the issue of the municipal services and the inspectors, the health inspectors, versus the Office of Standards Compliance. So people were very agitated to make sure that that was made clear. We received two comments from medical aides or related bodies, two comments, one from a national department, one from a provincial department, and then a group of four that came from a private pharmacy group, from the blood transfusion, and from individuals. So those were the comments that were received. And there you can see a summary of some of the issues that were raised by those organizations. The minister has already alluded to a number of those and how they were actually addressed in the revised bill. So a lot of people commented on the issue of the independence and governance of the office. There were both support and concerns around the function of the office to in the original bill, it said to develop norms and standards. It was felt that the process needed to be made clear, the scope needed to be made clear. We needed to specify how this related to the policy function of the national department. We needed to be sure that there was input possible into the norms and standards. The original bill spoke about donations, and there was a strong suggestion that this would encourage undue influence on the decisions of the body, so that has been removed. The environmental health officers, there was, as the minister alluded to, a confusion about this, and that is clarified in the new bill. The comment was that there was no real clarity about what the office should do when there was non-compliance, and there are provisions in the bill now for progressive action. It was commented that it was really unclear whether the body had jurisdiction over the private sector. In fact, in defining a health establishment, the definition does specifically include private sector establishments. So in technical terms, it is clear in the law, but it is clear more in the definition section. There was an urging that the inspection reports should be available to the public, that the transition arrangements weren't specified, but the bill now states that a proclamation will be made. There was also a suggestion that a body like this would require very extensive capacity, a very large staff, and that there should be provision made for the contracting of subcontracting of capacity to assist the office. And also with the appointment of experts, that the issue of regulatory duplication and overlap with other statutory bodies was raised, and that definitions were not always as clear as they should be. So that is really the comments that we received. So in the version that went to Cabinet, we did put a lot of effort into tightening the definitions, and I will go through the revised bill so that we can see how all of this is dealt with. There is specific provision for coordination among regulators. The donations have been excluded. The categories of inspectors and health officers are now clearly differentiated, although the powers are often similar, which is why it remains in the same amendment bill. But it's made very clear which is being alluded to. There is a provision for progressive requirement of achieving compliance with the standards. The body now has an advisory function to the minister on norms and standards, so it doesn't replace the policy function of developing norms and standards, but does advise the minister. The CEO now has security of tenure. that was a problem, that the CEO's security of tenure was not protected. A proclamation would cover the transitional arrangements, and the ability, as I said, to contract or appoint expertise has been inserted into the bill. Once the bill, the revised bill, was approved by Cabinet in July, it then went to the state law advisors. The state law advisors did a very thorough job of revising language, introducing clarity and logical sequence. And there had been an error in the first bill, which I'm really surprised no one actually commented on, but Section 18 had been deleted, which deals with complaints. And it was never the intention that this Ombuds Office should take over the entire complaints function. And Section 18, for those of you who were alert to the first bill, it was undeleted. So the function of dealing with complaints at a delivery level remains. So that hospitals and districts and clinics and provinces do still need to manage their complaints. But we do know that many complainants seek escalation of their complaints when they're not satisfied. So it is those escalated complaints that are covered by the Ombuds. The changes to Chapter 10 are summarized there, and as I said, we would go through the certified bill. But some of the main changes were to define the office as a juristic person, to tighten the provisions for the appointment of the CEO. The Ombud is now appointed directly by the minister and with its own separate vote. And there are provisions written into the bill to protect the independence of the Ombud. However, it is placed within the office and can use the staff of the office in order for us to make sure that the functions can reinforce each other where this is appropriate, but without undermining the independence of the Ombud. And there were also some, the state law advisors picked up some concerns with how the Tribunal for Appeals was established, and that was changed. So those two sections cover the policy processes that were followed, as well as the legislative processes that were followed in arriving at the bill that you have before you today. If I may, the next set of quite extensive set of slides, Chairperson, goes through the bill section by section. Should I just proceed? Okay. I think you all do have the bill in front of you. And so the purpose of the bill is to amend the National Health Act of 2003, which is the principal act, and to empower the minister to establish an independent entity called the Office of Standards Compliance. And afterwards we'll just refer to that as the office. The objectives of the office from the Memorandum of Objects is to advise the Minister on the development and implementation of enforceable norms and standards for quality and safety for the entire health system, to ensure compliance with these prescribed norms and standards, and to deal with complaints relating to norms and standards against the entire health system. And just in summary, that the office is headed by a chief executive officer appointed by the minister for a term of 5 years and an ombuds person located within the office. So, clause one of the amendment bill amends section one of the principal act in terms of its definitions. So, clause one of the bill in front of you goes through the amendment of critical definitions. Clause 2, as I pointed out, amends a certain clause in section 36C, simply in order to align the wording and reference consequent to the establishment of the office and rearrangement of section 10 of the Act. So this removes reference to the Office of Standards Compliance, which was in the original Act, and replaces it with the word the office. So this is merely a definitional change. Clause 3 amends section 47 of the Act. It deletes reference to the Office of Standards Compliance and the Inspectorates of Health Establishments and replaces them with the establishment of the National Office. As I referred to at the beginning, that was one of the policy decisions taken, is that this function would be a national one. Now, Clause 4 is the bulk of what is contained in the amendment bill. And there, with so many sections that it's hard to put it all on the page, it provides for those sections, and what I will do is I will go through each one of those sections, and I will outline what is contained in the amendment bill, and where relevant, make reference to why that was the way the bill was framed. So the first section is section 77, which establishes the office as a juristic person, which legally would be important to ensure the accountability and identity, as it were, of that office as a juristic person. It specifies also that the office is funded by parliamentary appropriation and by fees. So there is no reference to donations. And it makes clear that as this is the core business of government, the major funding would come through a parliamentary vote, but that revenue could be collected to progressively offset costs. I haven't copied every single section out of the bill. I mean, in section 77, it does also state that the office is subject to the Public Finance Management Act, but that is referred to a bit later, so I didn't actually copy every single phrase. Section 78 specifies these two primary objects of the office: monitoring compliance by health establishments with prescribed norms and standards, and ensuring the consideration, investigation, and disposal of complaints relating to non-compliance with norms and standards. There are then two slides on section 79, which outline the functions of the office. The functions are split into what the office must do and what the office may do. So what the office must do, which is section 79A to E or F, is to advise the minister on matters relating to norms and standards to be prescribed. And it goes into a bit more detail about matters relating to how they are determined and how they would be reviewed. Secondly, it must inspect and certify health establishments as being compliant or not compliant. So it makes specific provision that the office can withdraw a certificate of compliance. Thirdly, that it must investigate complaints relating to the national health system. Fourthly, that it must monitor and report on indicators of risk that would then indicate serious breaches of norms and standards and report any such breaches to the minister without delay to ensure that if something serious is brought to the attention of the office, it can be dealt with. It would identify areas and recommend urgent intervention as required, and would make recommendations to the minister on quality assurance and management systems. So in italics below, I have put in reference to the policy and scoping benchmarking work that we did, that I are gained through its work can influence policy development, regulation, and management systems. So that information, that knowledge is not lost. In the inspection and certification, it provides for a formal external management system, a measurement system. It also enables, through investigating complaints, that the patient experience is monitored in order to be able to identify system problems, but also enhance trust in the system so that patients know that their experience forms part of the standards against which health establishments will be assessed and certified. Through including the provision of monitoring indicators of risk, it makes sure that real-time information is available to the body. One of the deficiencies of an inspectorate function is that there's a long interval between inspections. The other deficiency is that it allows institutions to prepare so they can spend 2 months making sure that everything is good, and when the inspectorate arrives, everything looks beautiful, and then they can go and rest until the inspectorate comes again. So an early warning system enables the inspectorate to conduct ad hoc inspections at any time when they have reason to believe that there is a risk. And also, the body must then make an immediate recommendation for intervention. So that covers the first part of Section 79, which is the functions of the office. The second part of Section 79 is functions that the office may perform, and these cover the issuing of guidelines on the implementation of norms and standards, so that the office may issue guidelines for the benefit of health establishments on how they should implement norms and standards. It also provides for the body to be able to publish any information relating to prescribed norms and standards. So in fact, as the Minister alluded to, it could publish the norms and standards themselves, but also information on compliance with those norms and standards. It can collect or request any information from health establishments or from users. So it can ask for monitoring information, it can conduct surveys, so any information the body requires, the office requires, it can collect. It may also liaise with any other regulatory authority on matters of common interest, either in relation to general issues or specific complaints or investigations or problems. And it can go further to negotiate cooperative agreements with any regulatory authority in order to harmonize the exercise of jurisdiction over norms and standards and ensure the consistent application of the principles of the Act. So through this communication function, the office would enhance its capacity to drive voluntary compliance. So through communicating with users, but especially with health establishments, it would encourage voluntary compliance. So it wouldn't simply be the policeman coming along after the fact. It would ensure or try to ensure that when the inspectors arrive, they find the body is compliant, because the purpose of the Act is to ensure compliance. Secondly, through publishing the standards and the levels of compliance or risk, the primary objective of enhancing public accountability and trust would be encouraged. I think the collecting of data to identify risk I've already spoken about. And one of the big comments, as the Minister alluded to, was the need to ensure coordination with other regulators. So those are all covered now. If we then go on to Section 79, this covers the appointment of the Chief Executive Officer. So once again, I haven't copied what is in the bill. So I think you all do have the detail in front of you. But it covers that the CEO is appointed by the minister for a 5-year term that is renewable once, subject to a performance agreement. It specifies the grounds of removal from office. In 79A4, it specifies that the chief executive officer can be removed on account of serious misconduct, ill health, or inability to perform the functions of the office. That the minister can appoint an acting CEO and specifies the pension and retirement benefits of the CEO as being those of a head of department in the public service. So through these provisions, the revised bill seeks to ensure the security of tenure and the protection of the independence of the CEO. Section 79B covers the functions of the chief executive officer as the head and accounting officer of the office in terms of the PFMA and the requirement to appoint staff. The head is also accountable for the standard requirements of an efficient administration, the organization and control of staff, and there you will find that the chief executive officer can contract or enter into contracts with any person or organization to provide expertise or technical input, including conducting inspections. And this then specifies what the accounting officer should do and makes provisions to increase capacity, expertise, and thus credibility of the office. Section 79C just merely covers the delegation of powers and assignment of duties so that the CEO can delegate powers. Section 79D covers the accountability of and reporting by the chief executive officer. So it specifies that the chief executive officer must table an annual report in Parliament, must provide an annual report which the minister will table in Parliament in terms of the PFMA, must provide audited financial statements and the Auditor General's report and detail on the activities undertaken, and must also provide any report that the minister may request. The bill then goes on to section 80, which covers the appointment of health officers and inspectors. And it specifies in section 81 the appointment of health officers by the relevant authorities, namely the relevant member of the Executive Council or mayor, who may appoint a person in the employ of the national, provincial, or municipal department as a health officer, but then clarifies that the CEO of the office must appoint inspectors, and that both a health officer and an inspector must have credentials. They must have a certificate of appointment. And it concludes by saying that the health officer or an inspector needs to have the certificate, needs to present it when they enter any establishment or premises, and that they have the powers of a peace officer in law. And so this does clarify that they are not the same thing, although they have similar powers. Section 81 then goes on to cover the appointment of the ombudsman. So the minister must appoint a suitably qualified person for a 5-year term. It does outline the benefits, the terms of appointment of the ombudsman, with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, but specifies that the ombudsman would be located within the office and assisted while ensuring that it can also contribute to identifying the risks to quality, as the minister did outline, that the complaints from the public would therefore serve to actually inform the office directly and to utilize the powers and resources of the office. Section 81A outlines the functions of the ombuds. So it specifies that the ombuds may consider, investigate, and dispose of either a written or a verbal complaint relating to norms and standards, or can institute an investigation on his or her own initiative. So the ombud does not have to wait to get a specific formal complaint, and the use of a verbal complaint was specifically introduced to improve access, so that a telephone, a call center, could actually be used to enhance access. And that the ombud then must dispose of, consider, investigate, and dispose of such a complaint in a fair, timely, and expeditious manner. Such complaints could cover acts or omissions by either a manager or an employee in any health establishment or any place where health service is provided. It specifies there again that the ombud might use inspectors, or may use inspectors from the office, but also has the ombud has their own specified powers, including that to subpoena witnesses or informants, but with due regard for administrative and procedural fairness. Another thing that was added in was the ombud can refer a complaint to any other suitable body for investigation. So if a complainant has come to the ombud with a complaint of professional negligence, this could be referred to the relevant statutory body. If the person has come to the ombud with a complaint against a health facility in a specified province, which has not, having not even gone through the complaint system in that province, the ombud could refer the complainant to the province for initial investigation. It makes provision for the ombud to provide a report and recommendations to the CEO to action this through the channels that the CEO has, through the minister, through the DG, or through any of the provincial authorities or the owners of a private establishment. But in a case where the CEO and the ombud might not agree, the ombud can then approach the minister directly. So it does attempt to ensure the widest possible ambit of action without duplicating the functions that are already being dealt with by other bodies, and provides for a single coordinated channel of action, actioning recommendations, but while protecting the independence of the ombud. There is then a section titled Independence, Impartiality and Accountability of the Ombud, that is section 81B. I didn't go back to include it. This provides for earmarked funding to be provided to the ombud. So the ombud, while placed within the office, does have its own budget. It writes into law the requirement for the ombud and their staff to be fair and impartial, and that anybody must assist the ombud in this function, and that the ombud must provide an annual report to the minister that will be included in the report of the office. The bill then goes on to discuss inspections themselves in section 82. It provides for a health officer or an inspector to enter any premises, including a private dwelling, in the case of a health officer, or health services. Whereas health officers do need to be able to enter any private dwelling that may be constituting an environmental hazard. So it there specifies under section 82.1 that the health officer or inspector can inspect, can question any person, can require any person to produce any document, including health records, and can take samples or photographs of any relevant material. That an inspector or a health officer can be accompanied by an interpreter or any other person who might assist them, and that they may issue a compliance notice if they find serious non-compliance. So this section specifies the permitted actions, and however, that the inspector, as part of an office, their compliance notice would obviously, as the minister had said, be subject to organizational quality control and fair process. And some of that is specified in the bill. Section 82A is entitled Non-Compliance with Prescribed Norms and Standards, and specifies that a notice of non-compliance must be issued to the person in charge and must detail what is wrong, what has to be done to correct it, within what time frame, and what could be the penalties if that is not done. And such a notice remains in place until the establishment complies and the office therefore issues a notice of compliance, or unless the establishment successfully appeals, which is dealt with later on. It does make provision for some penalties, such as a fine not exceeding 10 million rand or referral for prosecution, and also provides that any serious finding must be reported to the Director General. There is then a specific section on environmental health investigations, which specifies the health officer's obligation to investigate pollution and nuisances and determine responsibility, to issue a compliance notice requiring corrective action. It makes provision for any aggrieved person to appeal, and also retains the provision that only a health officer registered under the Health Professions Act can actually exercise these powers. So this is specific to health officers. There are then a number of sections around the powers of entry and search, covering entry and search with a warrant, where the warrant would specify the power to enter any premise or establishment. It goes through the activities, including seizure of evidence, the obligations and rights of the occupants who are being searched, and the process and grounds by which the warrant would have been issued. Section 85 makes provision for where there is resistance to entry. It sets up the procedures that where the inspector or health officer has a warrant, what procedures must they follow if the person in charge of those premises, in the case of a health officer, or the health establishment, in the case of an inspector, if the person in charge denies entry. So the inspector or health officer does have power to enter, but the legislation specifies what they must do, and that they can overcome resistance if that is necessary. So it provides procedural guidance. Section 86 says that it is possible to enter premises without a warrant if a delay would be prejudicial to the actual investigation. So if a obtain a warrant would prejudice the obtaining of evidence either by the health officer or by the inspector, and if there are reasonable grounds to assume that a warrant would be issued if there were time to obtain it. So this is a provision for exceptional circumstances. Section 86A refers specifically to the constitutional right to privacy and specifies that any entry or search must be conducted with strict regard to decency and good order, including the right of the person to dignity, the right of a person to freedom and security, and the right of a person to privacy. Section 87 simply deals with the disposal of anything that might be seized and refers to the Criminal Procedure Act. Section 88 it's entitled a miscellaneous provision, but what it actually does is specify for the purposes of public sector organizations who is regarded as being the owner and occupier of a building or an establishment or the employer of any person. And it specifies that the head of a national or provincial department of health or the head of a municipality is regarded as being the owner and employer for the purposes of this act. So this is the specific situation of the accountable person in the public sector. Section 88A deals with appeals against the decisions of either the office or the ombudsman. So it specifies that the person must appeal in writing to, or may appeal to the minister in writing within 30 days, and that the minister must appoint an independent ad hoc tribunal of up to 3 persons, chaired by a retired judge or magistrate, and with the other 2 members having knowledge of the healthcare industry. And this tribunal may confer, vary, or set aside the decision and must notify the parties. So this makes the appeal function independent and protects the minister from any direct involvement in this process. Section 89 covers the offences and penalties and lists there that a person is guilty of an offence if they obstruct or hinder inspection or refuse to provide information or provide false information, if they impersonate a health officer or an inspector, if they fail to comply with a compliance notice, or if they disclose any information of a financial or business nature unless they're specifically ordered to do so, or if they obstruct hinder or obstruct the ombudsman, that should have been a separate bullet. And it makes provision for anyone, any offender, to be liable to a fine or to imprisonment of 10 years or to both. Clause 5, that was Clause 4, which was the amendment of Chapter 10. So right at the beginning I had a slide which had a long list of bullets. We went through every single one of the sections that were amended. Clause 5 amends Section 90 of the Principal Act to provide for consultation by the Minister with the office. So Section 90 of the Principal Act provides for consultation by the Minister with the National Health Council, but where the Minister makes regulations in terms of this, he will consult with the office, and that the Minister may prescribe fees to be paid to the officers for office for services rendered. And Section 6 amends the arrangement of sections, because by introducing these clauses, the numbering had to be changed. be around the name or title of the bill and the date of operation. And that is the end of my presentation. Thank you very much, James.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Thomas.